From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Nearly 20 people have died and hundreds remain missing in the worst series of wildfires in Northern California's history. The blazes that whipped through wine country and Napa and Sonoma counties destroyed thousands of buildings. A wetter winter last year led to a large supply of vegetation, fuel for the fires that then emerged from a hotter and drier than usual summer. Such conditions are expected to occur far more frequently as our planet's climate rapidly changes from the continuing production of greenhouse gas emissions. So transitioning to a new clean energy economy is inevitable, but who will benefit and who will get left behind in such a transition? Well, communities of color and low-income Americans across the nation, who are often the first victims of environmental racism, are leading the way in demanding equity in the transition to climate resilience. A new book gathers a number of powerful and innovative models in one place. Joining me to discuss it is Denise Fairchild, President and CEO of Emerald Cities Collaborative, which is a national nonprofit organization of business, labor, and community groups dedicated to climate resilience strategies that produce environmental, economic, and equity outcomes. And she is the co-editor of the new book, Energy Democracy, Advancing Equity in Clean Energy Solutions. Welcome to the program, Denise.
Thank you, Sonali. I'm glad to be a part of this conversation.
So the issue that I mentioned of those who are the worst hit by environmental disasters is, I think, central to this story. So we should start there. When we have talked about environmental racism and demanding environmental justice over many decades, we often talk about the fact that there is a pollution, there are industries that end up being placed where low-income communities and communities of color often live. So they often become the frontline communities that experience the impact of pollution and, of course, are also experiencing the impact of climate change, right?
Exactly. That's a wonderful framing for what the book Energy Democracy really is about. It's really, as the word democracy represents, an opportunity where grassroots organizations and everyday people are taking their energy future into their own hands to determine their own destiny, as democracy is designed to do. And it's really a direct result of the fact that many of our communities are living the horrors and the tragedies of coal burning and gas and oil burning. We live in toxic communities. We live near freeways. We live near factories. We live, most of us, over 50-60% of our communities live 30 miles away from a coal fire burning plant. And so we not only are living the impacts of climate change, so when we have extreme weather conditions and floods or tornadoes, that we are the first and the worst to have and realize the impacts. We can see what's happened, for example, in Puerto Rico right now, or the U.S. Virgin Islands, and even in the U.S., our communities, low-income communities of color, are the last to get help. They racialize recovery. We are, victimized by the hurricanes, and then we're victimized by the response of our governments to help us. So it's about time that we're seeing this current of activities, not only to just climate change, but also income inequality, as well as health inequities that happen to occur in our communities.
Right.
So this energy democracy is about clean energy, but it has racial and social justice at the forefront of a strategy to fix that.
And then there's the added dimension since last November of the coming to power of a regime that is bringing forward a sort of twofold assault, the continued unleashing of dirty energies, as we've seen EPA head Scott Pruitt, who has been a strong leader against, combating climate change, now unleashing the coal industry once more, undoing the modest work of the Obama administration. So they're unleashing the dirty energies again, and they are also reducing the number of regulations that had kept some of these industries somewhat in check. Maybe you can say there's a threefold assault, because of course they're also weakening our healthcare infrastructure. So people who deal with the impacts of pollution have less and less access to healthcare. So is today the world that we live in an even more urgent moment for the kinds of solutions you outline in the book?
Well, it's an ominous future that we're looking at, and the kind of loss of leadership that we have around environmental issues is pretty tragic. In fact, I think it's criminal. But I think what we are finding and what the stories of struggle are telling in the book on energy democracy is that we can, that there's a movement taking place, and these movements are happening at the local level. And when you think about the energy sector, there are two things that are happening that I think is in our favor. Number one, the energy sector is radically transforming itself. Imagine, just think about how the telephone is now, we've lost the landline and everybody is on the cell phone. That's a radical shift in how the telecommunication industry is working. The same thing is happening with the energy sector. It is at the end of its 100-year life, and it has to reinvent itself. So the question is, in this radical transformation of the energy sector, how is it going to look? Who's going to own it? Who's going to control it? And that's what the stories in this book are about, is that residents are making some definition about that future. And the other thing I've mentioned is that while the federal government is key, it's very important for how our environmental policies roll out, energy is regulated at the local level. So the power is in the hands of local residents to influence their local regulatory environment.
Let's talk about some of those ways in which that's already happening. We've had a wave of privatization and attempts to privatize, and to counter that, there are many examples around the country where people are looking at energy as part of their commons and forming cooperatives and really becoming individual stakeholders together. And you have several examples of that. Here, we are here in California. Can you give us some examples of the way in which local communities have actually tried to wrest more control over those energy companies that are, you know, doing the very basic job of providing energy?
Well, there are some amazing examples that run from the East Coast to rural Mississippi to the West Coast, and the currents of change are growing throughout the country. In California, particularly, a very active environment for energy democracy advocates. One example I would say, and probably California is leading the nation on this idea of community choice energy, which is a state enabling legislation, which is in many ways municipalizing energy. It's taking energy services away from the investor-owned utilities, so your Edison and the PG&E, and allowing municipal governments to actually provide energy services for their constituents. So what it does, as the name suggests, is two things. It gives communities involved in how this new energy infrastructure is going to be built and what kind of energy that's going to be used and how the energy is going to be distributed at what price. And we have a choice, all right? So we're participating, and we have a choice around, you know, whether we want gas, which we don't, or whether we want renewables, and how we're actually going to make those energy choices available for low-income communities of color. So my co-editor runs the local Clean Energy Alliance in Oakland, San Francisco, and they have been working very hard on the community choice legislation. As every city begins to roll out, and they anticipate 60% of all energy in California in 5 years will be under these community choice programs. So as you can imagine, the investor-owned utilities are resisting this, but the communities are at the table. In Alameda County, for example, they're working hard to put a business plan together to make sure that their labor and community standards that are embedded in the new energy programs, that there are jobs that are being created and that those jobs are going to be local. So that's one a strong example of how the energy sector is changing and communities are organizing and participating in how that new future looks.
What about the production of energy? Often when you have the Republican Party and even some members of the Democratic Party pandering to certain industries in their districts, they will hold up the low-income workers in those dirty industries as the reason for why those industries should continue. Oil workers, pipeline workers, which also sometimes becomes problematic with the positions that unions take on green energy, coal workers, etc. So shouldn't the production of the energy also be an important part of the story? And if so, how can there be a just transition to this form of cleaner energy? Because as one author in your book says, transition is inevitable, justice is not.
Great. Well, Sonali, thanks for reading the book and pointing that out. Yeah. We do have a chapter which really addresses the issue of labor. Well, we have several chapters that really address the issues of just transition and labor. It's a hard issue when you think of the fact that dirty energy has been the source of revenue, income, and family stability for thousands of people across the country for decades. But those are very, not only those dirty industries, but they're also impacting the health of the folks that work in these coal mines, that are working in these, you know, these oil fields. And so part of our agenda as part of an energy democracy strategy is to ensure that as we migrate to a new, cleaner energy future, that there is a process by which, number one, we bring the workers in the dirty industry sector into the new future, that we make sure that they're paid good living wages and not take the low wage road to the economy, and that we actually grow the sector. And what we're finding, the data suggests that there are more jobs now in the clean energy sector than there is in the dirty energy sector. But if you're not trained, if you have not been a part of that new energy future, there is concern, there is fear about whether or not you'll have a source of income. So our job in this just transition is to make sure that we don't leave anyone behind.
And so is it a matter of demanding that local governments fund training programs, where there is, where jobs are most needed, or is the federal government's job to do that? I mean, we do need money for these sorts of transitions. And often the government freely hands out subsidies to industries that end up lining corporate profits. But when subsidies are required to actually do job training for transitions to a green economy, we should, of course, hope that that money is found.
Right, exactly. Well, we have the 45th regime that has said that jobs and the economy is a primary objective. The unfortunate thing is that they're not looking at the jobs where there are opportunities for the future. The statistics are out that China is beating America and being competitive and everything from electric vehicles to clean energy sources and distributed energy technologies, and we're losing the opportunity to train, to build a sector, a clean energy sector, and to train a whole new cadre of current workers and future workers to build out that future. But the fact of the matter is that there is no getting away from the fact that we will be in a clean energy future. Even if you look at the oil and coal producing, the fossil fuel industries today, most of their facilities, their refineries, are obsolete. They have lived their life, and they have to rebuild new infrastructure. Well, the fact is that the new infrastructure is renewable, right? Gas and coal are now more expensive than using the sun or the wind as a source of energy. So when you think of it as just as a business proposition, you will find that people will take the cheapest source of energy, and right now it is going to be renewable energy. So we have got to, and I think industry itself, will be in a position to train the workforce of the clean energy future.
Let's also talk about how energy infrastructure is currently set up and how it really could be rewritten and rebuilt. You know, we have all of these high-profile fights against oil pipelines like the Keystone XL pipeline, the Dakota Access pipeline last year. That fight was such an inspiring struggle. Those modes of infrastructure of transporting oil from one part of the continent to the other part of the continent, isn't that part of the old, dirty, dinosaur energy, literally fossil fuels as we call them? So shouldn't a transition to a clean energy involve rethinking energy infrastructure, decentralizing energy infrastructure, which seems to go hand in hand with the idea of energy democracy?
Absolutely. When I talked about the fact that the energy future is going to be cleaner, it also means that the old energy infrastructure is obsolete. The new energy infrastructure is about distributive energy sources. Distributive energy really includes everything from panels on your solar roofs to community solar gardens to community grids. They are not the way it's been organized right now, which are central energy grids. Everything is, you know, well, the only thing we see is an outlet in our homes or in our offices, but all of it is connected to a central grid. And when that grid goes down, look what happens. You have the Puerto Ricos of the world where all the lights go out, all the sources of all our ability to cook and to plug in our iPhones and all of our mobility has then been compromised. And when we had Hurricane Superstorm Sandy in New York City and all the substations across the New York area went down, all of the lights went out, New York decided, well, we can't have this grid system anymore. We have got to have a decentralized system so that we have a backup, a redundancy, a way to be resilient in the event of extreme weather where the lights won't go out, or if it does go out, it won't go out for a long period of time. So distributive energy is the technology of the future. And the real question is, and I think some of the chapters in the book really address this, who owns that infrastructure? Is it going to be owned and controlled by the utility monopoly? Or is this new infrastructure going to actually serve the needs of the community, be owned by the community, and address issues of both income inequality and community wealth? And so it's a real exciting opportunity to think about distributive energy as an opportunity to build our communities in a different way.
So finally, Denise, give us some more examples of the kinds of models that have really worked. You mentioned New York, we talked about California earlier, but there's also some examples in your book about Mississippi, Detroit, Michigan, those places in our country that have been left behind by the old economic models, the old energy models, but where people who've been impacted by dirty energy are doing some incredible things. Give us some examples of those models that can inspire people and communities where such things don't exist yet.
Right. Well, one of the things I want your listening audience to realize is that these are very powerful stories in this book about people taking control of their own energy future, leadership, development, and training people about energy. I mean, that's not a sexy subject. It's not something that people think about every day as much as they think about food and their shelter and water. But folks are recognizing how energy impacts their lives in so many different ways. One of the things that, one of the stories in the book is really about the work in rural Mississippi. There's a coalition, an organization called One Voice. And if you might remember, in the 1930s, a lot of rural co-ops were established because the market refused to go and electrify the rural communities. So the Roosevelt provided low-interest loans to create these co-ops. Well, these co-ops, not all co-ops are alike. The co-ops that we're talking about today, co-ops are 2.0 version, are not like the rural co-ops that exist today. There are hundreds of them across the South. Most of the people, what's happening is that One Voice is knocking on the doors real community organizing, asking people, do you know you own an energy company? Most people do not know that they are part of the co-op, that they own this company. They are not getting dividends. They are not electing the leadership of their utility, and they're not getting the benefits of being an owner user of the co-ops. So they are training residents and these communities about the laws, about energy laws, and beginning to build the power of the community to reclaim these co-ops to be about not about power, not about profits, but about people and planets.
Well, Denise, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Is there a website for Emerald Cities Collaborative that people can find out more about the work you do?
Yes, just go to emeraldcities.org.
And we'll post a link to that from our website later today. Thank you again, Denise.
Thank you, Sonali, for the conversation.
My guest is Denise Fairchild. She is the president and CEO of Emerald Cities Collaborative, and we've been discussing the new book she has co-edited called Energy Democracy, Advancing Equity in Clean Energy Solutions. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.